Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholar Series, where great professors teach you. My name is George Wilson, and I'll be your host. Today we begin a course entitled Stranger Than Fiction, The Art of Literary Journalism. Your professor will be Professor William McKean. Professor McKean is a professor of journalism at the University of Florida. He teaches courses in writing, journalism history, literary journalism, and the history of rock and roll. Professor McKean received his Ph.D. in Higher Education Administration from the University of Oklahoma in 1986. He also holds a Master of Arts in Mass Communication and a Bachelor of Arts in History, both from Indiana University. Before beginning his teaching career, he worked for newspapers in Indiana, Florida, Kentucky, and Oklahoma. He has also been an editor for the American Spectator and the Saturday Evening Post, and, in addition to his academic duties, serves as book editor for Creative Loafing, a weekly arts and lifestyle magazine in Tampa, Florida. Professor McKean is the author of several books. Outlawed Journalist has been widely hailed as the definitive book on the iconoclastic journalist Hunter S. Thompson. Writing in the Times of London, critic Christopher Hitchens called it admirable and haunting. He has also published a memoir of a 6,000-mile road trip with his grown son, Highway 61. Rock and Roll is Here to Stay is a massive history of rock and roll and part of the Norton Anthology series. He has written several other books on American popular culture, literary journalism, and music. McKean is the father of 7 children and lives with his wife and whatever children are home at the moment on a small farm near Wacahuda, Florida. For more information on this course, please visit its webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites and a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students. And now we begin Stranger Than Fiction, The Art of Literary Journalism, Lecture 1, Ancestors.
Hello, fun seekers. Welcome to Stranger Than Fiction, which is a course in the Modern Scholar series about literary journalism. And if you wonder what literary journalism is, then good, because that's my job. I'm going to be talking about it. And before we get into any of the details of literary journalism, we have to talk a little bit about journalism itself and where it comes from. And really, it's as old as human beings on Earth, because we've always had a need for stories, and I guess we've always had a need for gossip, and, you know, stories and gossip together seem to form a lot of the material of modern journalism. And at some point, a long time ago, one of our hairy and unhygienic ancestors decided that a sound could mean a thing. They were used to going around and bumping into things and going, ugh! But then somebody decided that ugh! Would have a meaning. And maybe it was hand me the piano or give me the car keys or something like that. But whatever it was, someone a long time ago decided that a sound could mean a thing. And that's when we began having language. And then at another point, someone decided that there was a way to preserve those sounds in writing, to make a symbol that represented the sound. And that was an invention. So the invention of writing freed us, because then we could communicate with people that we couldn't see. We could communicate with people who weren't right next to us. We could pass a note that said, hand me the piano, or where is your smoke signal, or whatever. And that's when mass communication was born. So that's part of the human need we have for stories and storytelling and information. And there's something that resembled a newspaper as far back as, I don't know, 59 BC or so. And until the time of Gutenberg, at least in Europe, in the Western civilization, newspapers were hand-copied. But then when we began to have printing and the possibility of other interpretations of ideas, for example, once they printed the Bible, it wasn't just that which was read to you by the priest each week. You could read the Bible and think well, wow, I don't know that I believe the same things as Father Charlie with what he said. I think I believe this about this chapter of the Bible, and suddenly had the Church of Bob or the Church of Fred or whatever. So printing newspapers, putting ideas at loose in the world, it's really one of the things that that changed our culture. And I like to believe that the history of the United States in particular is the history of journalism, because journalism played such a huge part in the making of the country. In fact, if you look at the early revolutionary newspapers, they were filled with the news of Europe for several decades, until suddenly they began having stories about rallies for patriots who wanted to protest the taxes on this or that. In fact, you can look at the ancient newspapers from Boston and see a sort of rallying cry for the original Boston Tea Party. But after the Revolutionary War, the newspaper kind of settled into be something like the Wall Street Journal. And nothing against the Wall Street Journal, but imagine if that's all you had. It just wasn't very interesting for a lot of people. And so it wasn't until around the 1830s that newspaper editors in New York began experimenting with a new kind of journalism. They had newspapers that were smaller, meaning tabloid size, the size of the New York Post or the National Enquirer today. They sold them for only one penny, and they also contained news that people wanted to read, rather than the news about business or shipping or just politics. They had news on the neighbors. And I think it was Jane Austen who said, "For what reason do we exist but to make sport for our neighbors?" I mean, we love gossip. We love horrible things when they happen to other people. And so that was one of the intriguing things about the penny papers, as they were called, that came about in New York and then spread throughout the rest of the country in the 1830s. And symbolically, what it did was it gave information to people who had been denied information. Back then, it seems like we were a culture of information haves and information have-nots. And suddenly the have-nots were getting information from newspapers such as the New York Sun or the New York Herald, so forth. And it really changed the way people regarded reading. There was a great boost in literacy at the time. In fact, there's a little dialogue I imagine when somebody says to a friend, "Hey, did you see that in the paper about Dennis Mott?" "No, what about Dennis?" "Oh, Dennis was arrested for being drunk in the street." "Oh, wait a minute, let me see that." And they'd grab the newspaper and say, "Oh, wait a minute, I forgot. Darn it, I'm illiterate. I can't read." Well, finally, they had something that they wanted to read. And so a lot of people learned to read by reading newspapers. So newspapers, by the middle of the 19th century, were pretty well established as an important form. In fact, if you look at kind of the evolution of a frontier society, they'd build a town, they'd need a livery stable, they need a bar, they need a hotel, and they need a newspaper. And little towns had newspapers. In fact, going back to colonial days, villages in North America had two or three newspapers before some of the big cities of Europe even had them. So kind of the history of our country has been the history of mass communication. Now, when we talk about literary journalism, which is the subject of this course, we're talking about a certain kind of writing, and that's most of what we'll be discussing. But there's also the fact that journalism provided the literature of the building of the United States. And what historians have used when they go back and write the histories of this time are newspaper accounts. And, you know, in 100 years, you got to wonder, is it going to be as accessible to historians, these digital formats? You know, are the digital newspapers going to be preserved? Are emails going to be preserved? Because historians use letters a lot, too. So what I thought I wanted to talk about first here, before we get into literary journalism, is talk about the journalism that became our literature. And if you look back at that era in the middle of the 1800s, you can see that the press covered the whole westward migration. You can find accounts in newspapers that date from that time, the Milwaukee Journal, the St. Paul Pioneer Press, the Chicago Tribune. A lot of those newspapers relied on letter writers. they would ask somebody who's going west on a wagon train, say, would you send us a letter now and then and let us know what it's like? Because, you know, readers here want to know what life is like out west. They had to have some way to get the letters back to the editors, of course. And that usually involves somebody riding like hell on a horse. I was doing research once and I came across a classified ad. And it said, wanted, young, skinny, wiry fellows, not over 18, must be expert riders, willing to risk death daily. Orphans preferred. Wages, $25 per week. Apply Central Overland Express, Alta Building, Montgomery Street. And that, of course, was an ad for a Pony Express rider. Now, the Pony Express didn't really last that long, but it was a way to get information to people back in the East. So what I want to do now is read you a few of these accounts that perhaps are not the most splendidly written things, but they're part of the literature of the westward migration, as reported through journalism. And this is one called Life in the West, and I love the byline. It says, by a resident sucker, and it's from 1845. And it was just I guess we'd call him a citizen journalist these days, somebody who went west and sent this back to an editor back east. Land in this country is all held by private individuals and can be bought from $3 to $30 per acre. The soil is black, about 18 inches or 2 feet deep. The climate is mild and mild weather, rough and rough weather, sultry and debilitating in hot weather. In some places it is healthy, and in others it is otherwise. The moral and intellectual condition of the people is bad. Wisconsin and Iowa are both filled up with the scum of creation. No decent man would attempt to live in either territory. All the inhabitants of both places having run away from their former homes and are now, or ought to be, looked upon as outlaws. The greatest advantage in this country is plenty of cash. The greatest disadvantage is the want of it. Another account from 1849 is about the California Gold Rush. And again, no byline other than a prospector. That's the only way the writer's identified. And they're talking about the condition of the gold fields, which they call the diggins. What class of people ought to start for the diggins? Persons who have nothing to lose except their lives, and it should be just as well they start without these. If it were possible, they are not unlikely to lose them in California. Things you should not take with you to the diggins? A love of comforts, a taste for civilization, an appetite, a conscience, a respect for other people's throats, and a value for your own. What sort of society will you meet at the diggins? Those for whom the United States is not big enough, those for whom England is too hot, those who come to clean out the gold, and those who come to clean out the gold finders. How gold may best be extracted? By supplying at exorbitant prices the wants of those who gather it. What will be the ultimate effect of the discovery of the diggins? To raise prices, to ruin fools, to demoralize a new country first, and to settle it afterwards. You decide if that's the history of California in a nutshell. Now, today, we're all concerned with celebrities, and celebrity journalism is hugely popular. And there were celebrities then, too, and one of them was David Crockett, who, of course, was a great hero, died in the Alamo. Before that, of course, he was this backwoodsman figure and a member of Congress. He wrote in a column that he had in several of the newspapers. It was almost like a syndicated column. It was called Colonel Crockett's Notebook. He wrote this in 1835 about fame, and it was a Dateline Philadelphia. The people slung their hats and huzzaed. It struck me with astonishment to hear a strange people huzzaing for me. It made me feel sort of queer. I stepped onto the wharf where the folks came around, saying, give me the hand of an honest man. I did not know what this meant. But some gentleman took hold of me, and pressing through the crowd, put me into an elegant coach, drawn by 4 fine horses. They then told me to bow to the people. I did so, and with much difficulty we moved off. The streets were crowded to a great distance, and the windows full of people looked out, I suppose, to see a madman. As I said, the column was called Colonel Crockett's Notebook, and the last entry that I found, at least in my research, is datelined Nacogdoches, Texas. I was for many years a member of Congress. In my last campaign, I told my people that if they saw fit to reelect me, I would serve them as faithful as I had done. But if not, they could go to hell and I would go to Texas. Here I am. And, of course, he was on his way to the Alamo. There are some other things that you find when you look back on the journalism that became literature. And one is, I guess we're always surprised by the revelation that people 100, 200 years ago were aware of what was going on when it was happening. We always, I think that we're the people that, looking back, can provide the wisdom. This is a piece that appeared in the Saturday Evening Post in 1850. It was by a Chippewa Indian named Kagigagabwa. I just love to say that, Kagigagabwa. He had an anglicized name, but I forget what it was. But remember, this is 1850. I will give you the grounds of my fears of why the Indians will never have a permanent hold upon any part of the Western country, unless by special act of Congress. For years, the fires of the Indian Lodge have been moved west. Their rights have been trampled upon by settlers, and this, with other annoyances, has ever unsettled the minds of the Indians. The consequence has been, and ever will be, that they will remove step by step to escape the annoyance. The present belief of the Western and Southwestern nations is that they will never again be moved, and that the land they now occupy will be theirs forever. What sort of guarantee do they have of continuing on the land unmolested? Will not the same plea that was given to move the Massachusetts, New York, Ohio, and Georgia Indians, will not the same plea of necessity and, as some say, as an act of kindness to them, be urged on those on the other side of the Father of Waters, as has been urged on this side? If not this, enterprise, yes, Yankee enterprise, will require railroads to be laid out, canals to be opened, military roads cut through the land of the Indians in the West, and their land must either be bought from them or taken. And when this is done or commenced to be done, they will cease to work in their lands, since such labor would not be in their benefit, but for those who must occupy it when they leave it. The delightful fields of the Indians in Georgia were the greatest objects the white men desired for themselves. There is a rich spot of land this side of the desert below the Rocky Mountains, the only rich land, and the Indian has been placed on this like a barrier. The land so occupied, if not cultivated, the paleface will reason himself into the idea that the Great Spirit intended to make the whole of North America a farmland, and thereby justify himself for taking to till what the Indian could not improve. Necessity will oblige the Indian to sell. Our fathers sold their lands to the government and lived on the proceeds of this sale, and soon the government will want to buy this land, and our children will live on the annuities as we do now on ours. So they will fare no worse than we have. In this way, they will become impoverished and will have to sell their lands piece by piece until all is gone and they suffer. 1850. It's pretty incredible. Well, that's sort of the literature of the history, I guess, of the Western migration. When we talk about journalists who wrote things as journalism that endured as literature, I think in the United States we'd probably have to start with Mark Twain. Because if you were to look at a history of journalism textbook, and, you know, I'm not sure I can imagine anything more dreary, you'll find out that the textbooks leave out a lot of the really great people who worked in journalism, like Mark Twain, or H.L. Mencken, or Ring Lardner. If they didn't own a major newspaper, or they weren't the head of some media conglomerate, it seems like they don't make it into journalism history. But Mark Twain had this childhood that's just been a fantastic source for his fiction. But he learned to write, really, as a journalist. He followed his brother into the business. Sam Clemens was Mark Twain's real name, of course, and Sam was born in a little town called Florida, Missouri, and his father really wanted to become the most respected citizen in this little town, so he found this tiny town, set up shop, assumed that the river that fed the town, the Salt River, would be dredged, and he could become a shipping magnet. Well, it never happened. So eventually he gave up and moved to Hannibal and became a justice of the peace and began raising his family. Well, Sam had an older brother named Orion, and Orion went into journalism. And so when the father died, Sam needed to help support the family. He followed his brother into journalism. In fact, his brother by that time owned his own newspaper in Hannibal. And when he had to leave town on a fundraising trip or whatever it was, he left Sam in charge. And I think he was 16, 17 years old when that happened. And that's when Sam the kid sort of became Sam the important writer. One of the things he did was he wrote a story about the rival editor across town in at another newspaper. And I remember, as I said, back then, small towns would have two or three newspapers. And he wrote that the rival editor had been jilted in love and tried to kill himself by drowning, and even had an illustration of the other editor going out with a yardstick, measuring the Mississippi at that point, making sure it was sufficient to drown him. Well, it was an outrageous story. The editor said he was angry, he was going to come clean house, beat up Sam Clemens. It never happened, but that was the beginning of this distinguished career in journalism. And wherever Orion went, because he went from Hannibal to Keokuk, Iowa, he went back east, it seems that Sam followed him. And eventually, after a brief service for the Confederate side in the Civil War, Sam followed his brother out to Nevada. And his brother had become the territorial secretary of Nevada in Lincoln's administration. And Sam went out there first to be a miner, but that didn't work very well. And so he decided to start writing for a newspaper in Virginia City, Nevada, called the Territorial Enterprise. And he didn't want to embarrass his brother because of, you know, his brother was in this position of authority. So he wrote under a fake name. He wrote under the name Josh. And the editors liked it so much they invited him to come join the staff. And so he ended up marching 60 miles through the desert and came into the office hygienically challenged and announced himself and said, "Can you bring me some rope? I need to tie myself together. I'm falling apart. My name is Clemens. I've come to write for your newspaper." What a great entrance. Anyway, after a while, he began writing more stories and decided he needed a new fake name. So he came up with Mark Twain, which of course means safe water. It was a sound that he used to hear people calling at night when he was a pilot on the Mississippi River. So at some point, I believe it was Ernest Hemingway who said that the first real voice in American literature was the voice of Mark Twain and Huckleberry Finn. And that's a voice that was shaped by being a journalist, because he worked all over the place. He worked out west. He worked in Missouri. He worked in the east. As a matter of fact, he was editor of the newspaper in Buffalo. His term as editor of the newspaper in Buffalo came after his first fame as an author. But I wanted to read this one story about his career as a journalist in Tennessee. "I was told by the physician that a southern climate would improve my health, so I went down to Tennessee and got a job on the Morning Glory and Johnson County War Whoop as associate editor. When I went on duty, I found the chief editor sitting tilted back in a three-legged chair with his feet on a pine table. There was another pine table in the room and another afflicted chair, and both were half buried under newspapers and scraps and sheets of manuscript. There was a wooden box of sand sprinkled with cigar stubs and old soldiers, and a stove with the door hanging by its upper hinge. The chief editor had a long-tailed black frock coat on and white linen pants. His boots were small and neatly blacked. He wore a ruffled shirt, a large seal ring, a standing collar of obsolete pattern, and a checkered neckerchief with the ends hanging down. Date of costume about 1848. He was smoking a cigar and trying to think of a word, and in pawing his hair, he had rumpled his locks a good deal. He was scowling fearfully, and I had judged that he was concocting a particularly knotty editorial. He told me to take the exchanges, skim through them, and write up an article called The Spirit of the Tennessee Press, condensing into the article all of their contents that seemed of interest. I wrote as follows. The Spirit of the Tennessee Press. The editors of the semi-weekly Earthquake evidently labor under a misapprehension with regard to the Ballyhack Railroad. It is not the object of the company to leave Buzzardsville off to one side. On the contrary, they consider it one of the most important points along the line, and consequently have no desire to slight it. The gentlemen of the Earthquake will, of course, take pleasure in making the correction. John W. Blossom, Esquire, the able editor of the Higginsville Thunderbolt and Battle Cry of Freedom, arrived in the city yesterday. He is stopping at the Van Buren House. We observe that our contemporary of the Mud Springs Morning Howl has fallen into the error of supposing that the election of Van Werter is not an established fact. But he will have discovered his mistake before this reminder reaches him, no doubt. He was doubtless misled by incomplete election returns. It is pleasant to note that the city of Blathersville is endeavoring to contract with some New York gentleman to pave its well-nigh impassable streets with Nicholson pavement, The Daily Hurrah urges the measure with ability and seems confident of ultimate success. I pass my manuscript over to the chief editor for acceptance, alteration, or destruction. He glanced at it and his face clouded. He ran his eye down the pages, and his countenance grew portentous. It was easy to see that something was wrong. Presently he sprang up and said, "Thunder and lightning! Do you suppose I'm going to speak of those cattle that way? Do you suppose my subscribers are going to stand such gruel as that? Give me the pen." I never saw a pen scrape and scratch its way so viciously or plow through another man's verbs and adjectives so relentlessly. While he was in the midst of his work, somebody shot at him through the open window and marred the symmetry of my ear. "Ah," said the chief, "it's that scoundrel Smith of the Moral Volcano. He was due here yesterday." And he snatched a navy revolver from his belt and fired. Smith dropped, shot in the thigh. The shot spoiled Smith's aim, who was taking a second chance, and he crippled a stranger. "It was me. Merely a finger shot off." Then the chief editor went on with his erasures and interlineations. Just as he finished them, a hand grenade came down the stovepipe, and the explosion shivered the stove into 1,000 fragments. However, it did no further damage except that a vagrant piece knocked a couple of my teeth out. "That stove is utterly ruined," said the chief editor. I said I believed it was. "Well, no matter. We don't want it in this kind of weather. I know who did it. I'll get him. Now here is the way this stuff ought to be written." I took the manuscript. It was scarred with erasures and interlineations until its mother wouldn't have known it if it had one. It now read as follows. "The spirit of the Tennessee Press. The inveterate liars of the semi-weekly earthquake are evidently endeavoring to palm off on a noble and chivalrous people another of their vile and brutal falsehoods with regard to that most glorious conception of the 19th century, the Ballyhack Railroad. The idea that Buzzardsville was to be left off at one side originated in their own fulsome brains, or rather in the settlings which they regard as brains. They had better swallow this lie if they want to save their abandoned reptile carcasses the cowhiding they so richly deserve. That ass, Blossom, of the Higginsville Thunderbolt and Battle Cry of Freedom, is down here again, sponging at the Van Buren. We observe that the besotted blackguard of the Mud Springs Morning Howl is giving out, with his usual propensity for lying, that Van Werter is not elected. The heaven-born mission of journalism is to disseminate truth, to eradicate error, to educate, refine, and elevate the tone of public morals and manners, and make all men more gentle, more virtuous, more charitable, and in all ways better and holier and happier. And yet this black-hearted scoundrel degrades his great office persistently to the dissemination of falsehood, calumny, vituperation, and vulgarity. Blathersville wants a Nicholson pavement. It wants a jail and a poorhouse more. Ha! The idea of a pavement in a one-horse town composed of 2 gin mills, a blacksmith shop, and that mustard plaster of a newspaper, the Daily Hurrah. The crawling insect Buckner, who edits the Hurrah, is braying about his business with his customary imbecility and imagining he is talking sense. "Now that is the way to write," the editor said, "peppery and to the point. Mush and milk journalism gives me the fantods." About this time, a brick came through the window with a splintering crash and gave me a considerable jolt in the back. I moved out of range and began to feel in the way. The chief said, "That was the colonel, likely. I've been expecting him for 2 days. He'll be up now right away." He was correct. The colonel appeared in the door a moment afterward with a dragoon revolver in his hand. He said, "Sir, have I the honor of addressing the poltroon who edits this mangy newspaper?" "You have," the chief said. "Be seated, sir. Careful of the chair. One of the legs is gone. I believe I have the honor of addressing the putrid liar, Colonel Blatherskite Tecumseh." "Right, sir. I have a little account to settle with you. If you're at leisure, we will begin." "Well, I have an article on the encouraging progress of moral and intellectual development in America to finish. But there's no hurry. Begin." Both pistols rang out their fierce clamor at the same instant. The chief lost a lock of his hair, and the colonel's bullet ended its career in the fleshy part of my thigh. The colonel's left shoulder was chipped a little. They fired again. Both missed their men this time, but I got my share, a shot in the arm. At the third fire, both gentlemen were wounded slightly, and I had a knuckle chipped. I then said I believed I would go out and take a walk. This was a private matter, and I had a delicacy about participating in it further. but both gentlemen begged me to keep my seat and assured me I was not in the way. They then talked about the elections and the crops while they reloaded, and I fell to tying up my wounds. But presently they opened fire again with animation, and every shot took effect. But it's proper to remark that 5 out of the 6 fell to my share. The 6th one mortally wounded the colonel, who remarked, with good humor, that he had to say good morning now, he had business uptown. He then inquired his way to the undertaker's and left. Then the chief turned to me and said, I'm expecting company to dinner, and I have to go home to get ready. It'll be a favor to me if you will read proof and tend to the customers. I winced a little at the idea of attending to the customers, but I was too bewildered by the fusillade still ringing in my ears to think of anything to say. The chief continued. Jones will be here at 3. Cowhide him. Gillespie will call earlier, perhaps. Throw him out the window. Ferguson will be along about 4. Kill him. That's all for today, I believe. If you have any odd time, write a blistering article on the police. Give the chief inspector rats. Cowhides are under the table, weapons in the drawer, ammunition there in the corner, lint and bandages up there in the pigeonholes. In case of accident, go to Lancet, the surgeon downstairs. He advertises and we take it out in trade. He was gone. I shuddered. At the end of the next 3 hours, I had been through perils so awful that all peace of mind and all cheerfulness were gone from me. Gillespie had called, but thrown me out the window. Jones arrived promptly, and when I got ready to do the cowhiding, he took the job off my hands. In an encounter with a stranger, not in the bill of fare, I had lost my scalp. Another stranger, by the name of Thompson, left me a mere wreck and ruin of chaotic rags. And at last, at bay in the corner, beset by an infuriated mob of editors, blacklegs, politicians, and desperados, who raved and swore and flourished their weapons about my head until the air shimmered with glancing flashes of steel, I was in the act of resigning my job in the paper when the chief arrived, and with him a rabble of charmed and enthusiastic friends. Then ensued a scene of riot and carnage such as no human pen, or steel one either, could describe. People were shot, probed, dismembered, blown up, thrown out the window. There was a brief tornado of murky blasphemy, with a confused and frantic war dance glimmering through it. And then all was over. In 5 minutes there was silence, and the gory chief and I sat alone and surveyed the sanguinary ruin that strewed the floor around us. He said, "You'll like this place once you get used to it." I said, "I'll have to get you to excuse me. I think maybe I might write to suit you after a while. As soon as I'd had some practice and learned the language, I'm confident I could. But to speak the plain truth, that sort of energy of expression has its inconveniences, and a man is liable to interruption. You see that yourself. Vigorous writing is calculated to elevate the public, no doubt. But then I do not like to attract so much attention as it calls forth. I can't write with comfort when I am interrupted as much as I have been today. I like this job well enough, but I don't like to be left here to wait on the customers. The experiences are novel, I grant you, and entertaining too, after a fashion, but they're not judiciously distributed. A gentleman shoots at you through the window and cripples me. A bombshell comes down the stovepipe for your gratification and sends the stove down my throat. A friend drops in to swap compliments with you and freckles me with bullet holes until my skin won't hold my principles. You go to dinner, and Jones comes with his cowhide. Gillespie throws me out the window. Thompson tears all my clothes off, and an entire stranger takes my scalp with the easy freedom of an old acquaintance. And in less than 5 minutes, all the blackguards in the country arrive in the war paint and proceed to scare the rest of me to death with their tomahawks. Take it all together, I never had such a spirited time in all my life as I've had today. Now, I like you, and I like your calm, unruffled way of explaining things to the customers. But you see, I am not used to it. The Southern heart is too impulsive. Southern hospitality is too lavish with the stranger. The paragraphs which I have written today, and whose cold sentences your masterly hand has infused the fervent spirit of Tennessean journalism, will wake up another nest of hornets. All that mob of editors will come, and they will come hungry. They will want somebody for breakfast. I shall have to bid you adieu. I decline to be present at those festivities. I came south for my health. I will go back on the same errand, and suddenly, Tennessee journalism is too stirring for me. After which we parted with mutual regret, and I took apartments at the hospital. Now, that was a piece that Mark Twain wrote in 1869, and it shows what a distinctive voice he already had, and that was a voice that owed itself to journalism, just as Ring Lardner, who came along some years later writing about sports, got his voice into the newspaper. The score at the time was 4-2. Us had the 4, them had the 2. H.L. Mencken also began his career in journalism in the early part of the 20th century, around the same time as Ring Lardner. The fact is, a lot of great writers have really found their voice in journalism. The focus of this course is going to be mostly on the style of journalism that emerged from the New Yorker magazine around the time of the Second World War, but which flowered in the 1960s and has become such a part of the fabric of journalism today. But we can't forget these ancestors. We can't forget Mark Twain, Ring Lardner, H.L. Mencken, the people who found their voices first in American journalism. In the next lecture, we're going to pick up the story in the middle of the 20th century with one of the most horrific events in our history, the bombing of Hiroshima, and how that was reported by John Hersey, the great literary journalist and novelist.
This ends Lecture 1.